So yeah, we're gonna see some stuff.
Pink princess crown.
That's a teddy bear.
This is classic Florida scenery.
Oh yeah. No gators inside though.
Too cold.
Why do we have to do this right when there's a cold front?
Yeah. Wait. One, two, one, two. Okay, that's good.
Three, four.
Yep.
We're a team. You do one, two, I do three, four.
Yeah. All right. So as long as you keep your back to it and I keep my back sort of to it, this is good. Welcome to Catching Up. I am here right now in a very sunny, warm, tropical climate of Florida, right?
Right.
I am sitting alongside Yost Dubois, aka Toast Dubois, Juiced Jost, Jost Dubois. He gets all the names. And probably for the rest of this podcast, you'll just listen to him talk because he's a much better talker than I am. And once he goes, he goes. But we are sitting on the Crystal River in Florida. This is just one of the places that he and I tend to cross paths the most because we're both on the road so much, but we both sort of live in Florida and bounce between Florida and the Netherlands. So we tend to meet up more often in Florida than we do in even the Netherlands. But we've got manatees floating around us. This is a pretty clean river compared to ones that we're used to seeing for the ocean cleanup. And Yost, introduce yourself. Give me just a quick background of who you are inside this organization.
Yeah, where to start then? I'm Yost Dubois. I'm the head of communications for the ocean cleanup for quite a while now. First time I met Boyan is 7 years ago this month. And he got me hooked. And I've been doing this ever since. Picking up guys like you, Dan, on the way.
On the side of the road?
Well, not particularly on the side of the road as I remember it, but definitely picking you up. Yeah, and very happy about it.
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah. Me too.
I like to, definitely I'm in the C-suite of the ocean cleanup, whatever that may mean. But the chief promises officer, I think, is a good summary of what I do, what we do with our team. We put out the promises that the ocean cleanup holds. And it definitely started there. And what is really, really great to see happening over the past 2-3 years is to be able to put impact against that promise and basically tell the story, take everybody along in the story on how we are actually making it all happen.
And we are making it happen. And you see this probably more than most people being as inside of the story as you are. But one thing that I really love about you, Yost, is that you sort of stay behind the scenes. You're never really at the forefront of the action.
Yeah, I don't like to be on stage. If I have to, I'll be there, like we had in Victoria a year ago when suddenly we didn't have a master of ceremony for that press conference. But I rather stay behind the scenes, look at myself like Charlie from Charlie's Angels, talking to you from a box.
Charlie's Angels, so that just dated you a little bit, Yost.
Yeah, I'm talking about the original Angels, not the new generation.
So you're dating yourself even more.
Yeah, Boyan once asked me if I were alive when Elvis was alive. I said yes. I was almost allowed to drive.
Take me through your earliest memory with Mr. Slatt. How did this all come about?
I got a call from a good old friend of mine who was working for a foundation in the Netherlands planning to make a donation to the ocean cleanup, and they asked me if I could do some due diligence on the communication quality of the ocean cleanup. Back then it was like a dozen people, so it was still very easy to do that due diligence. I visited twice, I wrote a report, of course had my first conversations with Boyan. And I think we clicked. I mean, we have very similar visual minds, I think. And he definitely understands communication and positioning and branding very, very well. And we connected. he invited me to come work. I had to laugh a little bit at that one. And then I decided to start in a sabbatical for the ocean cleanup on January 1st, 2016.
You mentioned the branding and that your vision was very similar to Boyan's. Why is the branding so important? And why are you so strict with the branding that we use for our organization?
Yeah, well, that's where the promises come in, I think. I do believe that the ocean cleanup brings a promise of hope and positivity. We also try to keep the brand really humble and authentic and friendly and curious, which is a direct link, I think, to the fact that we do love our science. The brand itself, of course, is almost two-dimensional. The ocean cleanup and our logo, it's very, very simple and very descriptive, which at the same time makes it a very challenging brand to work from a brand management point of view and registration point of view, which is also one of the reasons that I do run a pretty tight ship internally on how to use the brand and how to not abuse the brand to make sure that we maintain our registered status around the world. I'm pretty proud that we managed to register the Ocean Cleanup as a trademark in many, many countries around the world.
And explain that a little bit deeper. Why is this so important? With a name like the Ocean Cleanup, why is registering our name so important?
The clearest example, I think, were our sunglasses. So the sunglasses are actually the Ocean Cleanup registered trademark sunglasses, because we have registered the trademark in products as well as in services. So it's both a registered name for what we do as well as for what we bring to market. And if we sell these sunglasses that are made from verified plastic taken out of the ocean by this organization that is very recognizable and is named the Ocean Cleanup, and we can all make that official, because that is what the little R does, it means so much more, and it becomes way more serious also on a legal point of view.
Because going forward with our mission in the future, we need this as sort of a vehicle, correct?
Yes, and there are people that try to use our name to their own benefit, and that is something that we really want to avoid. The Ocean Cleanup is us, and we need to be careful that nobody is taking advantage of the good name and fame and the good story that we put out there. We're not commercial. We are a non-profit project organization. We are here not to sustain ourselves, but your donations will actually help us to get out of business quicker. That's the way the world needs to understand us. And that's something that we protect, among others, by being very strict with our branding.
And one thing you mentioned there was the story, our story, and the importance of our story. Now, we have a communications team that is quite large compared to some organizations, and we cover all of the bases, and you put this team together single-handedly, really. Why was this so important to you in the early days, and how have you maintained it? Because it is incredible when you look around at some of the roles that we have filled and the specialties that are in them and how they're used to communicate the story to the world.
Well, it started because there was just a lot of work, and the first need I had was somebody that could film and take pictures better than I could do it with my phone, and we found this Swiss guy, and he sent some footage of how he was filming skiers that were making saltos while he was jumping, and he still kept them in the frame. And I was like, okay, maybe that's a good one to start with. And so we picked them up from the side of the road, I think.
A lot of people on the side of the road in this organization. happy wanderers, huh?
Yeah. It's it immediately makes me think of Peter, who really was on the side of the road. he came back from the Rio Olympics and didn't know what to do with his life. He was skinny as hell, being the still back then the coxswain of the Dutch men's eight that he had been doing for 10 years. And I met him and I needed a project manager, and I'd been working with Olympians before, and I know that they can be ruthlessly strict in making stuff happen. So that is how I hired Peter. That was another story.
So the importance is there, because, you know, we often, when outsiders look at the ocean cleanup, of course they assume it's brilliant engineers and tough operations people and project managers and HR and lawyers, but you don't think of a team like what you have assembled there as well. And I think when I look around now after being there over 5 years, the thing I appreciate is it's like a tight-run ship of a huge media organization almost. And we do tell the story. And when I travel around the world, whether I'm in LA or in Kanto, every person that I come up to knows about the ocean cleanup through, obviously, prior to yours and my generations, not having Instagram and Twitter and Facebook and all the social media. But everybody is plugged into that now all over the world. I don't care if you're in a village in Vietnam or if you're in the city of LA. You know social media. So I feel like it's something that was so important, and we sort of evolved along with it. Do you feel this way as well?
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, as Boyan used to say, we were practically born on Facebook. And I think we've been lucky. In the beginning, certainly, we were early adapters with the ocean cleanup. And when I came, there was a very solid basis of that first positioning in social media. And I think what I did with the help of the team and some really brilliant folks that I've been able to meet and tag along and take into the organization is to really, really build that out to a serious, large group of followers with incredible engagement. I mean, we know that from the social media organizations themselves, that they are amazed by how much engagement we manage to maintain with the people that follow us. And that's something that I'm really proud of.
But yet we still cover all of the bases. Now we have, you know, there's some older dinosaurs like yourself and Alex Tobin. Just kidding, I'm just shouting out to Alex. We still follow, there's still print, there's still television. We are literally covering every aspect of getting our story out to the public that we can think of, including you and I sitting here right now recording a podcast. It's so important that we don't leave out any ears or eyes or perspectives in telling this story, right? Because it is such a global story.
Yeah, and you therefore need to play the organ on all registers and understand the channels that are there. And as you mentioned, I mean, if we really want to reach a lot of people, you need traditional media as well. So for the peak moments, we really try to gain attention in the big traditional media. And fortunately, we have shown to be very successful at that as well.
And not only in telling the story, but it's funny because I've been going back listening through some of the podcasts and some of the conversations that I've had with, like, Stephen Pallman. Stephen Pallman is an example of somebody that works for the ocean cleanup, that is doing amazing things for the ocean cleanup right now, that the reason he's there is from watching the Wilson live event. That's what inspired him to apply for his position and become part of something that he finds very important. How does that make you feel as the sort of head honcho of communications, that it's not only getting the story out to the world, but it's also creating the next generation of what we are doing in the mission of the ocean cleanup?
Well, it's an example that we are successful at the mandate that we have. So our role for the ocean cleanup is basically to position us as an attractive charity and drive the engine that is bringing in the money. We're a non-profit, so we need to explain that, and we need to be attractive and make people understand what we're doing and that we do need continued support. And the other part of the mission is to attract talent and tell the story as it is. I mean, this is an extremely exciting place to work, and it's wonderful to see what type of people and quality of people we've been able to attract. Really, really impressive, very international. Happy.
But we're not perfect, and we have our flaws, and we do remain pretty transparent. In your opinion, where are our struggles? Where do we struggle as an organization? Like, what are some of the examples, whether it's on the engineering side, whether it's on the resource-wise, growing too fast, too quickly? We have, it's not been perfect.
No, well, starting with the fast growth, I mean, that what I see is what I've experienced before. Doesn't make me really nervous. Fast growth is painful. And organizations will have to adapt because they get bigger and roles change and things get formal or more formalized and need to get more formalized. Very traditional growing pains that I see in the organization. Struggles, I think we're still very clearly in the validation, certainly for rivers. We are starting to understand how to do this. We've done 10 out of 1,000 rivers that we are aiming for. So it's still early days. And I think our communication struggle is more that people expect things to immediately be perfect. And that is simply not possible and not happening. So it's more maintaining that balance. Like, yeah, we are going to do what we promise, but we're not there yet. And so rivers, early days, oceans. I mean, I still rerun the extraction videos on deck of the tender. I mean, that is like so much the way I imagined it to be. And to see how we get better at doing this every time we do it, that repetition, the volume of trash that we dump on deck, the extreme motivation and engagement of the crew cleaning it up every time. Imagine you're there. Well, you've been there, very far away from home, very far away from land for weeks at a stretch. You tow for a few days, then you dump it all on deck. You spend almost a day sorting it and putting it in bags and in containers. And then you're towing again, and 3 days later, you're doing the same thing over and over. I applaud these guys. And to me, they're a demonstration that we're on the right track. And the thing we have to do now is grow, scale it up. System 3, nickname still to be revealed, is going to be 3 times the size of System 2. And Jenny has been such a faithful performer. And she's going into her winter sleep now for a well-deserved couple of months of restoration and rest. And then in spring, we will continue to run the transformation from System 002 to System 03. And is that a struggle? I don't think so. I mean, I'm extremely proud to see that we are making it happen.
So you've mentioned some of these moments, some of them which we've streamed live, some of them which we've covered just in depth. What moment stands out to you as your all-time favorite moment? And I'm sure, as deep as you've been in with the entire storyline, it's not an obvious choice, right?
No. I knew that you were going to ask that question. That's really terrible. Let's take the listeners along then, because we've been almost all of them. We had a first one where you were not present was in June 2016 when we did our first prototype launch out of Scheveningen. We were such amateurs, and it was all very, very shoestring. Not just the budget, but everything was shoestring. And then a year later, May 2017, and you were still with CNN and covering that story, we had our first event of a scale that I thought was worthy of the ocean cleanup. And we announced that we were going to start the cleanup within a year. Well, that year was a little longer, because in September 2018, we had another massive life event, which was the tow out of Wilson from San Francisco and going under the Golden Gate Bridge. As a dear friend of ours repeats on every video we have about this, this is the iconic moment, the moment we've all been waiting for. And then we had the first catch in June 2019 with system 001B. I just skipped the part where system one broke. That was not so much a highlight, but a wonderful challenge for communication. What do we got after 2019? We got 2020. That was the sunglasses launch during COVID. I mean, the setup of that event, although it didn't have the impact that I was looking forward to in the 2 years running up to it, but the setting of that event, what you remember, with all the screens hanging from the ceiling, and I had the incredible honor to be the warm-up for the people that were connected. So we had these live early birds connected to the event location, and they would be engaging with Boyan when he was doing his part of the presentation, and I had the honor to be there and warm them up. And to be there and be surrounded by these large screens with these people that we really had a live connection with, that was so incredibly wonderful and magical, actually. It was, I will never forget that moment. And then a year later, we did something crazy in the port of Rotterdam, and we launched an interceptor. And I still remember, I think it was June, I went to the last Rolling Stones concert that I will ever attend in Jacksonville. And they started playing Sympathy for the Devil. And we were in this huge stadium in Jacksonville, the football stadium, and they had these screens and they were flashing white lights, and the entire, I was thinking, if you're epileptic, you have a real problem right now. And then I thought, this is what I want for the uncovering of the interceptor, because we had this challenge that we had this massive screen that was covering the interceptor before it would be revealed. And it couldn't move up that fast. The cranes were not quick enough. So we used that idea to just flash crazy bright white lights into everybody and make a lot of noise to let that moment be special and not give too much attention to the fact that it was moving up so slowly. That was 21.
No,
right?
You got. I hate to call you out, Yost, but you got your years.
The years are
mixed
wrong.
Up.
Yeah.
2019 was the launch of the interceptor, and then we did the sunglasses.
Oh, yeah.
Because the interceptor was
COVID
first.
Was after but the interceptor.
It's all a blur.
It's becoming short-term memory. Maybe that is. Maybe it's a sign to take a step back again. Yeah.
But out of these experiences, which one has been your scariest so far? Which one has been the moment where, and without uncovering too much, which one kept you up the most at night to where it could have been the most dramatic for the organization in your point of view?
Looking back, the scariest one was in May 2017, because like 10 minutes before the show opened, the screen didn't work. Well, these are always exciting, and you prepare for the worst and for the best at the same time. You have to be a crazy dreamer and an optimist to run shows like this. I remember your look when I told you that I wanted 12 cameras to cover the tow out in the bay, and we did it. I mean, it ended up only being 7, I think, but you found a way, you knew how to do it, not immediately, but a few days after I put that challenge out. And I think that is the way we work as a team. And yeah, I'm never really nervous. There's a good adrenaline rush, of course. And there's one shot, I don't know if you took it, but there's one shot at the start of the interceptor launch where you may see some fear in my eyes. But it all landed well again.
Yeah, you need a certain amount of fear to be the gasoline that fuels the engine, I think. Otherwise, it just sits there. You need something that gets it going. There has to be something that drives it, and that's what I've always found. And that's what I think you give that to everybody and the whole organization. You don't just communicate with the communications team. You're plugged in. It's something that I think we all have followed. I know I certainly do. I stay as plugged into what's going on with the rivers as I can, as any human can with this team. And you stay alert and plugged in, and then that's the only way that you can ebb and flow and learn and go forward. As we're sitting here on the water and we have boats going back and forth, water is something that I know is very important to you. Why is being on the water, being around water, working for an organization called the Ocean Cleanup, so such a big part of your life?
Yeah, I've always been a water guy. I mean, I don't care too much about the mountains. I really love water, oceans, lakes, everything. I'm a sailor. I'm a rower. I love to be out in the water, and I'm a surface guy. I'm not a scuba diver. I don't go under the water or in the water that much. It's more being on the water and around it, and just sitting here on the shore of this river, ending up in the Gulf a few miles down. Yeah, it makes me happy.
Good. So going forward in this state of happiness that you are in, what's the future like for Yost de Bois? How much longer, at what point is it, okay, we scale up rivers, we scale up the ocean, it becomes a well-oiled machine, you know, we're getting older. I said we this time, as in.
I hear that.
Because some of the stuff I think you and I, being of the, we're not the young kids anymore. And that's always been something that I've appreciated about the Ocean Cleanup. It's the first place that I worked where I felt like I was one of the elders, let's say. But it's funny because I don't think anybody caught on to it until 3 years into my career working there that I was almost old enough to be a lot of their fathers. But for you going forward, what is the future? Where do you see yourself in 10 years? Obviously, you can't still be at the Ocean Cleanup in 10 years, right?
In 10 years, not. I will be retired then. So I will not be there until 2040. I'm not going to be part of the team that celebrates that we achieved the final goal. I hope I'm still around to witness it and to, I don't know if Twitter would still exist, but send a tweet about it. But no, 10 years from now, I will have slowed down. And that is what is happening in the coming 10 years. I mean, I'm very committed to the Ocean Cleanup. I love what I'm doing, but towards 10 years from now, I will definitely try to slow down a little bit. And I see a team that is extremely capable. I think I've trained you all also to be very professional in your roles and very confident in your roles. It's definitely a team, very close-knit group of people. And there is a manatee and two.
Oh, yep.
Here.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Now, the day is complete then.
Yeah.
So, yeah, maybe care for manatees or something in 10 years from now. I don't know. I live in the moment very much, but I do try to prepare for the fact that I won't be able to do this. You and I are the ones that are traveling most. You're more away. I'm more on the way, I think. I've been home 50% of the time over the past couple of years.
I don't even know where home is anymore.
Well, yeah, that is because you confused yourself, I think. That's not the ocean cleanup's doing. We're happy here. Here my wife is working at the University of Florida, and she's very happy with her working environment. And I also cannot not travel, just like you. It's a disease. I don't know how it will work out.
I don't either. I just keep going.
Well, don't keep going until you drop. I think that is something where we have to keep an eye on each other. But
Definitely. I do love the saying, it's better to walk off the field than to be carried off the field. And I've had that feeling definitely in the last couple of years as things get crazier and further away. But on the other hand, I'm like you. It's in my blood. It's in my adrenaline. You can't stop. Like, it is a difficult balance to find. But I think also, as we see the story, I don't believe will come to a close in our career, like you said, but I think we will at least get it to at least be a part of it, to the point of where the confidence is there that we know it's happening, that we can then hand it off to the kids and know that it's being taken care of and being handled, and that this hope that we've sold is actually happening, right?
Yeah, well, the coming 2 years are going to be really crucial in that sense, that we will have to demonstrate that we are capable of scaling up. So as said before, we're still pretty early. We are showing that we can do it, that the technology works, that the concepts are valid. Now we need to scale it up. And that is going to require a different focus. It's also going to require a lot of money. And we are preparing for that. I think we have the right people on board to do it. And so the only thing we have to do now is actually do it.
Well, let's do it. From the Crystal River, the home of these two manatees at least, I'm sitting alongside of Yost de Bois. And we are in, it's not so warm Florida right now, but it is Florida.
And sunny.
Yeah, in between trips. Yost, I do want to thank you. It's a pleasure. It's always a pleasure catching up with you. Most of the time we do catch up, it is in Florida these days, which is weird. But please keep listening, supporting us. As Yost says, we are getting there. We're close. It is a great story, and we want to continue telling it, but also fulfilling our end of the bargain, right?
Yeah, so definitely.
Yeah, so thanks a lot and have a great day.
Well said, Dan. Thank you.
That's always the worst part of this, is those stupid closes. I always feel like such a cheese ball when I'm sitting there saying like, da 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 da.
Well, I can say thank you then.
Oh yeah, we'll let Yost say thank you. Go ahead. Well, send us away.
Okay, well, this was the 20-somethingth episode of Catching Up, our podcast, hosted by the incredible Dan Vanderkooy. And thanks for listening. Tune in again. Please rate us in your podcast app, because that will help us push the listener numbers. And Dan will be back with you again in a month.
It's true. All right. See you later.
The day is complete.
Yeah.
What is a day without manatees? It's a pity we didn't record their snorkeling yet.
There was two of them out there.
Oh no, that's a bird.
A bird.